Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on assessing the CFPB's proposed debt collection rule. Consumer advocates and the credit and collection industry are at opposing ends of the spectrum when assessing the CFPB's debt collection rule, but now the industry can hear from one of the leading consumer advocates as she shares her perspectives. In this webinar, Roseanne Anderson from Ontario Systems and Margot Saunders, Senior Counsel of the National Consumer Law Center, are here to talk today about the CFPB's proposed debt collection rule. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Ontario Systems. You'll get the chance to hear more about them later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She is responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her two decades of experience in the ARM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the ARM industry. Margot Saunders is currently senior counsel to the National Consumer Law Center after serving as managing attorney of the NCLC's Washington, D.C. office between 1991 and 2005. Margot has testified before Congress more than two dozen times and has served as an expert witness in more than 50 consumer credit cases in more than 20 states. She is a co-author of the NCLC's Consumer Banking and Payments Law, many articles, and a contributor to numerous other manuals. Prior to joining NCLC, she was a consumer law specialist for North Carolina Legal Services. In 1991, Margot was the second recipient of the Vern Countryman Award. She is a graduate of Brandeis University and the University of North Carolina School of Law. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and once the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask for everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the feedback survey helps me develop the content. That's what you're looking for. And to find the speakers like the ones we have today, who are the people you want and need to hear from. With that, I've concluded my introductory remarks and let's jump into the discussion. First, to sort of set the stage for what's to come in the next hour, I'd like to give Roseanne and Margot each a chance to sort of share any opening thoughts about the proposed rule, any comments, anything sort of generally before we start diving into specifics. And Roseanne, since you're up on my screen now, I'll give you the chance to go first.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you for arranging this webinar. And special thanks to Margot Saunders for agreeing to participate. This is somewhat of a rare opportunity in my book. Margot and I go way back in terms of my advocacy experience and hers. And it's just a personal delight of mine to have the opportunity to basically exchange information with one another. One of the reasons I'm also very excited about this particular webinar is that oftentimes the more we understand one another, the more we can reach some common ground, if not common understanding, and really an appreciation for where the other party may be coming from. So that's part of the impetus behind this webinar, is to really give people like myself and the attendees an opportunity to really listen and understand where consumer and advocacy groups may be coming from with regard to the proposed rules. Mike asked me to comment a little bit about the proposed rules themselves, and while industry is generally quite receptive to the proposed rules, their focus on electronic communications, obviously there are opportunities for improvement in the eyes of the industry, but a few attributes of the rules are worth mentioning at this point, then we'll go into allow Margot the floor. One thing I did want to remind people is that these are proposed rules. I have actually seen people come out with position statements as though these are the rules, and these are not rules just yet. Nor do they have the force and effect of law at this point. So while you may think that, oh, well, if we're going along with what the CFPB is thinking now, that must be okay, it's a premature position to take. The law, the FDCPA, the case law, that's what is in effect today. That's what people need to be mindful of. So whenever you attend these kinds of webinars, be aware of the fact that you are learning about possibly what may come in the future, not what is here today. When these proposed rules do take effect, assuming they will at some point in their final form, they will have the force and effect of law. Not all administrative rulemaking does have the force and effect of law, but we have it from the CFPB's authority that these will, which means that this does not replace the FDCPA. It supplements, it explains, it interprets various provisions of the FDCPA. So with that, I think I'm ready to pass it off to Margo, and then we'll begin with our questions. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you, Roseanne. Margo? I think you might be on mute, Margo. Can you hear me? Margo, going once. Roseanne, can you still hear me?
I can. Do you think she's disconnected accidentally?
She still appears to be connected, but her line does appear to be muted. So, Margo, if you can hear me.
Margo, and I will just let you, and she's not on the computer connection, right, Mike?
Yeah, she's just called in via phone.
Yeah. Maybe you can reach out to her on the side. In the meantime, I might just give people an overview of what we're going to be talking about, and also
sure.
I can just stop talking on command. The other comment we're going to be, or a point I wanted to make at some point in our discussion this afternoon is the fact that the commission letters are coming back. Unless they take them out of the final rules, we will again be back to the days where some of you may remember we had the opportunity in the early years to write to the Federal Trade Commission and ask the commission for its an opinion letter on.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes. Margo, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I could hear you and I was not on mute and I was saying hello, hello. So I just thought I'd call you from another line. So
I appreciate you doing that. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, you all must have been really panicking.
Yes. Not really panicking yet, but we were definitely heading in that direction.
Heading in that direction.
Oh, no, what did this crazy consumer advocate do? Okay. Anyway, thank you for inviting me to join you all. And let me just say that Roseanne and I do go way back. We have several things in common, the same kind of dogs, sons with the same names.
Mm-hmm.
And we share an affection for each other. But however, I do not think we view this rule in the same light. Consumer advocates are disappointed, is putting it mildly. We think this is a significant opportunity. This was a significant opportunity for the Bureau to do a lot of good things to protect consumers from abusive actors, and which the Bureau has apparently chosen to not take. There are a number of problems with the rule. There are many more problems, in our view, even potential illegalities, than there are benefits to consumers from the rule. We are particularly concerned, for example, about the allowance of electronic communications to replace writings without requiring consumer consent, as e-sign requires it. But anyway, that's my quick summary. You can ask me questions as you'd like.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. When the proposed rule was first released in May, there were a lot of reports, especially in the mainstream media, about how debt collectors were going to be able to send, quote unquote, an unlimited number of texts and emails under the proposed rule. And even Director Craninger came out and said that the FDCPA's harassment provisions are still going to be in place. If there are concerns about collectors sending too many texts and emails, what would have been an appropriate cap on those communication channels, do you think?
So those concerns did not come from our shop, or not under my authority, if they did, and they might have been originally. Okay. But I think that was somewhat of a miscommunication. We are concerned about the high number of calls that the rule proposed rule would allow. We think that the number of texts, there is no cap on the number of texts, but the rule does permit consumers to say, stop calling or stop texting or stop communicating with me via any particular medium. And we think that's good. We're a little disappointed that there's not some requirement to tell consumers that they have that right. But that, we think, should provide some limit on the texts and emails. You know, people can block people on an email, we think email is a preferred way of communicating once the consumer has opted into communicating by email. So that is not a concern. To the extent that debt collectors are using automated dialers to send texts, consumers will always be able to, in our view, in our interpretation of the law, will always be able to say, stop texting, and that should stop the texts if they're in fact sent by an automated dialing system, unless you're in the Second Circuit.
Excellent, thank you. Roseanne, any comments about the lack of a cap on the number of electronic communications, or to Margot's point that she made earlier about the advocacy would have liked to have seen more an opt-in as well as the opt-out to receiving those types of messages?
Right. I do have a couple of comments. I think the CFPB was a little bit, the hands were tied a little in the sense that the CAN Spam Act is out there, which certainly impacts email, which takes a position that consumers always have the right to unsubscribe. And there are other CAN spam. So it's, in my opinion, it's possible that other safeguards were viewed as sufficient to protect consumers. I'm not here to argue that the consumers are misguided. I'm just simply saying that between canned spam and the fact that if you send too many emails to an address, you can be spammed and blocked by a carrier or provider, you know, the underlying platform, and same with text. So I was wondering about that too, because I think it's very important for us to keep everyone legally to keep our story straight, that texts are calls and emails are writing. And it helps to apply the law when you know which is which. And I was a little surprised that texts were not subject to the restriction, the caps at all. But my thinking after just focusing on it a bit, I understand it's because you do have to include, you have the right to opt out at any time in every text, and also the fact that you can be shut down again by carriers if you are an excessive texter. So that's kind of what I think might have been their thought, but I don't actually know that.
Okay. Margaret, with respect to seeking an opt-in, do you have a vision for how that would have worked or looked like from the collection agency perspective?
So can I back up and say what our concern is? There is a significant number, you know, those of us who work regularly in jobs that use computers tend to believe that everybody has as much ubiquitous access to the internet as we do. And I think that the Bureau was under that misunderstanding as well. When I live in a very rural area of West Virginia, and when I talk to my neighbors, especially the lower income ones, or I visit a local legal services program and ask them about their clients, most poor people do not have access to the internet like we do. We've just published an article on actually the statistics, but there's millions and millions of families in this country that don't have access to the internet except through their smartphones. And to the extent that they have access through their smartphones, it's limited access, only available when they have Wi-Fi, and the folks who don't work in offices don't have Wi-Fi nearly as often and as easily as those of us who do. When they pay for a small amount of bandwidth directly as a part of their monthly program, they don't have a lot. And even if they can get on the internet, that does not mean that they can actually download information that is sent to them through emails or disclosed on an internet site. And even if they can access it, that doesn't mean they can see it, because you're looking at a tiny, tiny little screen. And even if they can see it, they have no way generally of printing it or keeping it or retaining it. And all of these are really big problems, especially when you add them together, that spells a real difficulty for many people, especially people who are most likely dealing with unpaid debts because something terrible happened to them. And they're going to miss important information from debt collectors about the debts that are being collected against them. So this is the opposite problem. We're not worried about too many emails. We're worried about consumers actually receiving their emails and being able to access the information that accompanies the emails. And that is one of the most serious problems in this rule, in our opinion, because so many very low-income people don't have equal access to that information, don't have equal ability to retain it, and won't see it, and so on. If you can imagine me standing before you all, jumping up and down, saying this is really important. That's what I would say. We're very, very disappointed about this. I just one more point on that, and that is that many of you may have heard about Lifeline phones, which are the types of telephones that are provided for at low cost to poor people enable them to have cell phones. If you have ever tried one of those phones, they purport to have access to the internet, and they purport to have access to apps, but they don't. They're so clunky that they just, really all they're good for is talking and texting. So I realize I haven't quite answered your question, but that's the problem.
No, I think that's fascinating. What do you think about the fact that absent a manually delivered text, let's talk about that automated platform delivered text where the TCPA applies, that you mentioned, that technically, texting a consumer requires their consent when it's delivered via platform. So do you feel, let's not get to email yet, but do you feel like at least that side of the equation is covered because you could not text without consent?
So let's divide this into two different issues. One is communication, and the other is using electronic records to replace writing requirements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So certainly if the consumer has given you the consumer's phone, his or her phone number, then text is a perfectly good way to communicate. And if the consumer gave the creditor their phone number, then under TCPA rules, that information is allowed to pass through, and an implied consent is allowed to pass through to the debt collector.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue really with texts goes to whether you're communicating with the correct consumer, and whether you stop texting if the consumer says revoke, you know,
right.
Stop texting me.
Right.
So the problem with texts for non-writing communications really only goes to, are you sure you're communicating with the right consumer? You know, if you,
right.
if I have Roseanne's old phone number and some debt collector's saying to me on my phone, hey, Roseanne, pay up, you owe this amount of money, the Bank of America, that's a breach of your privacy that I'm getting this information, especially if they, you know, if I text back and say, what are you talking about? What's the debt that you're talking about? And then they give me more information about that debt that
mm-hmm.
might include your name and your address and, you know, mm-hmm. who knows what else in an attempt to answer my questions, but I'm not you. So,
and even so, I would agree that the TCPA has not changed. You shall have consent at this point from the consumer with whom you are communicating. We don't have any.
Right. So in that,
I mean, so that's
but,
still,
in, mm-hmm. but in that scenario, the debt collector has Roseanne's consent, but the debt collector is communicating with me. Now, once I say to the debt collector, stop, because I'm not Roseanne, I'm no longer harmed. I'm raising the different question that if let's say I don't say stop, I say, okay, verify this debt, tell me about the debt, and then the debt collector responds with, here's all this information, you know, it's really Roseanne Anderson, and she lives at such and such, and that's a violation of Roseanne's privacy.
Well, it's also a violation of the third part of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act as it exists today. So I would like to suggest that behavior, you may want it addressed in the rules, but I do believe that going on ad nauseum to the wrong party is still a violation of the FDCPA today.
Right. And we are proposing in our comments that for original communications through text, ignoring
mm-hmm.
the whole writing replacement issue,
mm-hmm.
but just
mm-hmm.
the communication issue, that we're suggesting that the texters comply with the reassigned number database to assure that they are actually dealing with Roseanne and not Margot.
Right. And they put that with regard to email, do you know, now that does not have the TCPA protection looming behind it. So for consumers, so with regard to consent and center. So when you get to email, there's more of a, I know the new rules talk about different way, a bona fide error procedure to implement if you are a debt collector to ensure the email address is acceptable. So
yeah, but the whole thing in this proposal is the email is, it's okay to send me an email if you sent me a previous email. None of that says there's no requirement that I have responded to that email to indicate that I actually got that previous
mm-hmm.
email. It's kind of a bootstrap, an absurd proposal, especially to the extent that it proposes to allow any of those emails to replace writing requirements. And here again, what I'm concerned with is not too many communications. It's not actually reaching me. It's not informing me of the critical information that the FDCPA requires the debt collector to inform me about.
I would say that touches on, as far as I'm concerned, for both sides of the aisle, that touches on what I find to be the biggest point of confusion in the collection environment, period. And remember years and years ago how you'd say, quit with the FDCPA amendment. You can use e-sign to send a legally required disclosure document, one that's required in writing. And I remember that distinctly from our early days together, and that has not changed. What people I don't think understand is that the whole point of eSign, and maybe I think you'll agree, is to make sure that the gall darn email address you're using is one that the consumer actually accesses.
Bingo.
Knows that they're going to be, you know, it's not some dumb email address, right? That's the whole point. So I the new rules, you should see the groups of people. We're all like struggling. What do they mean? But when it comes right down to it, I mean, that's the point. The point is, because if you were going to mail somebody, you wouldn't just open up your window and just hope that the envelope lands in the right place. You know, you have an address so that people are purportedly live at a residence. You know what I mean? So
there's the
same logic, I feel.
There's a big difference between mailing and emailing. If you mail someone something, first of all, there's a mechanism to forward your mail. Mm-hmm. And so if you mail something to my old address and I've forwarded my mail, I'll likely get it. Or if you mail something to my address that I lived in 5 years ago, people live there, and there's at least the opportunity for them to say, hey, Margo, I've got some mail for you, or to respond and say, no, you know, they're not here, but so that you know that I didn't get it. But so there's some possibility, you know, it's not by any means certain, but there's some possibility that either I will get it or you will be notified that I didn't get it. But email, if I was sitting at home and somebody came by and said, would you like to buy some new windows, which is and had me sign a consumer credit sales agreement on their laptop that they brought with them and set up for me while I'm sitting there in my own living room with using their laptop an email allowing them to send those documents to me electronically, and then one of you debt collectors got that email to used to collect a debt against me, I would never remember. Most people never remember what the email was, what the password was, even if they have a mechanism to get into email. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem that we are seeing repeatedly all through Georgia and the southern states and California, where we're seeing these PACE loans that are deliberately electronic and deliberately problematic, in our opinion.
Well, I do think that it's interesting to hear those scenarios, but I would say that eSign properly applied. And I don't even know that really was eSign because they didn't demonstrate any. I mean, that sounds a little fishy.
Exactly. And there's not been, and there are cases that are now percolating through the courts that will interpret whether eSign's consent provision in that scenario has been complied with. Mm-hmm. But it has not. I would answer, in my opinion, that eSign was not complied with. But regardless of that, let's say, you know, the debt collector is going to come along later. They'll get they'll get the debt to collect. And then they will get the email that was used to send those initial disclosures to, and the debt collector will not have any way of knowing that whether or not that consumer ever responded. They're not asked to determine that. That is not part of the dynamic in this proposed rule. And so that's really problematic.
What about the proposed rule where it says under the required disclosure section, that they do say that if the debt collector seeks to substitute the electronic delivery of the validation notice, the name of the original creditor, or verification information, they shall comply with eSign. If they choose to do it, don't forget about the alternative with the creditor.
Yeah, if they choose to do it, but they can also not comply with eSign by sending an email to an email address that they previously sent to and the consumer didn't object.
But not for eSign. Now, that's true. They can send emails, but they can't.
But not for the but they can. We read it that they can for the validation notice.
Really?
And that's a big problem.
You mean if it's in the body?
So unless I'm misunderstanding something, we read this to allow emails to stand in the stead of writings, which include the verification notice. And that is a big problem for us.
Yeah, and I think when I'm hoping the CFPB will clarify that. There is confusion in the industry as well over that. They did throw in this tag on for the validation notice in the very last section. I think that's what you're referring to. And it creates, everybody's wondering, is that a loophole, the e-sign or not?
Where are you reading from? Just so I can
follow. I'm reading from it's right after .42. And it has... it's on page 481. It's 1006.42E2. It's on page 481. It's right after safe harbors, and it talks about when the validation notice is contained in the initial communication. And I think this is where the CFPB tried to go as far as it could, but it got wrapped around the axle a little bit, because the FDCPA provides that it you must send the valid, like within 5 days of the initial communication, you have to send in writing this validation notice to a consumer, unless you've already provided it in the initial communication. So it suggests, actually it states, that the initial communication doesn't trigger the writing requirement if you give the validation notice in the initial communication. And that's true today. Like if you call somebody and give them and read them the validation notice, you're done. You don't have to mail it. You did it. So they're trying to figure out now, what are we going to do about e-sign if you could legally give a validation notice if it's the first one, if it need not be in writing. You know what I mean? They can't, hard to trigger e-sign. So then they say you could put the validation notice in the body of the email in this section. And then they go on to talk about how they're trying to grant.
Right, and that's because the validation notice, if it's sent with the initial communication, doesn't require a writing.
Right.
So this is, we're all being very tricky, you know, and this is very complicated. The problem is, if the point is to require that the collector get certain information to the consumer, this should not be the way we're doing it. The rule should be flatly, regardless of what the statute says, you always must make sure that that validation notice is sent either in writing on paper by snail mail or by email after receiving some kind of e-sign consent from the consumer that indicates the consumer can access. That's the point of the statute.
Right.
But I'm not disputing that the statute does allow the initial communication to contain the validation notice, which doesn't then trigger the writing.
Right.
But I'm trying to turn it around and point out the whole point of it.
Yeah.
And if, in fact, you're trying to get the consumer to pay the bill, that seems like a much better practice to actually inform the consumer of what's going on and communicate with the consumer in a way that convinces the consumer that he or she actually owes it and that it's fair and appropriate to pay it. But tricking the consumer into paying something or having to respond to a garnishment notice because they missed all the prior notices isn't good policy. But it's
And garnishment, well, just to our audience is clear, the CFPB is only dancing around the three required disclosures it listed. I think it's leaving something like any other sort of service of process or anything else to existing law and court rules, et cetera. But I get your point. I do get your point. One, what do you think about this whole business with the out of statute debt? And there's no, a lot of people were surprised. It's not like we're looking for notice requirements, but we're surprised that there is no standard language with regard that a collection agency or that a debt collector, a third-party debt collector, has to place in a collection notice with regard to out-of-statute debt. Were the consumer groups surprised at all about that?
Well, I should say we were disappointed.
Okay.
We think that it actually is very hard to imagine a disclosure that appropriately apprises the least sophisticated consumer of the risks of paying an out-of-statute debt. I mean, regarding collection on an out-of-statute debt, this proposed rule goes backwards in allowing threats of litigation or actual litigation. The cases were fairly uniform, saying that was not allowed, and now they've reversed that. This is another instance in which consumers have not been protected by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but collectors have been.
And I wonder if the notice, I can go both ways on that one, but I wonder if this is one thing that people listening to us discuss these new rules may not appreciate. Maybe they do more than we do, but the CFPB, it can't preempt state law. I'm not suggesting that including a special text requirement for out-of-statute debt would, but they do have to play within the guidelines or stay within their lane, so to speak, people like to say. And I'm wondering if that may be an issue with regard to, let's say, for the consumer groups wishing they had gone a little bit further. Do you think that those kinds of restrictions...
The Sabrifa outline had pretty neatly provided a means for the Bureau to stay within its lane by saying that if a debt was subject to collection after the statute had run, then that debt could no longer be collected against or on by a collector if, as a result of those collection activities, the consumer had done, I'm saying it wrong. Let me start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
The Sabrifa outline had said that if a debt was collected upon after the statute of limitations ran, and if the consumer, as a result of those collection activities, had done something to revive the debt such that the statute of limitations was no longer applicable, then the subsequently the debt collector could not use that revival as a ground for suing on the debt. Now, that wasn't saying that no one could sue on the debt, although I don't know who could, but it was saying that it would be an unfair, or I think it said an unfair practice or deceptive practice in violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to sue on the debt, which doesn't technically violate state law, but it does effectively override state law on the difference between statute of limitations and the statute of repose. But maybe that's why this Bureau didn't include that, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not either.
You would know better than I would.
No, not necessarily. well, I've been in conversations with people recently too about the fact that notwithstanding the provision of the FDCPA where a debt collector shall not make false threats or claim that it intends to do something it does not actually intend to do, such as sue a person, and that kind of triggers this out of statute debt business. I will just state that I think of a debt collector, I remember talking to the FTC years ago, and they were saying, well, we're concerned about the fact that some debt collectors, I've never heard of anyone myself ever do this, but they would, somebody would pay 50 cents on the debt and that would revive it. And I feel like this whole dialogue around out of statute debt blew up, and now no longer is it really simply, and not counting Wisconsin and Mississippi, but it's not an affirmative defense anymore. It's actually a bar to litigation. Do you see any justice?
Well, it is. Really? I think it is a bar to litigation for debt collectors. But let me turn that around. Who among, and I realize you can't actually, so it's somewhat of a rhetorical question, but who among us could prove that they paid a debt off that was paid off 8 years ago? Who has records like that?
Nobody.
I mean, I'm pretty type A, and I don't have records to show that I paid off a particular debt 8 years ago. I can't prove that I did. Or that I didn't have a particular debt 8 years ago. So the statute of limitations really is a problem, and especially when it's a very long one, because it for these very old debts, consumers can't prove a negative quite often. You know, they can't prove that they did pay it off, and that's why the whole practice of suing on out of statute debt smacks quite often of deception, or at least taking advantage of people's lack of ability to prove that they did pay it or that they never owed it.
Well, it's another one of those where, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think the burden of proof should be on the plaintiff bringing the collection action. And if the judges allow, you know, really a lack of proof that the consumer owes it, I guess that's one thing. But I do hear what you're saying, because I know many of us don't. For heaven's sakes, how many of us go shopping and you lose the receipt within 30 days, you're stuck with something. So, I mean, there is a question of responsibility and record keeping. Mike, Margo and I have kind of gone off on our own here.
No. The less I'm involved, the less I talk, I think the better off everybody is. So I've been, you know, listening raptly to the conversation, the discussion that you have had. But I will take this moment to pause for a second and remind everybody that today's webinar on assessing the CFPB's proposed debt collection rule is being sponsored by Ontario Systems. In nature, evolution tends toward the complex. In the ARM industry, companies evolve by simplifying their operations. Ontario Systems, the leader in ARM technology, helps you move past integration into true optimization, where you'll be free to compete on a whole new level. From its intelligent collections platform and cloud-based contact management to the latest omnichannel solutions for texting consumers and accepting payments online, go beyond integration with Ontario Systems. To learn more, please visit www.ontariosystems.com/go-beyond-integration. Thanks again to Ontario Systems for sponsoring today's webinar. We do have a number of questions that have been submitted so far, and maybe we'll use this as an opportunity to take one or two, and then also remind everybody that if you have a question, type it in, and we'll try and get to it before the end of the conversation. Question, if debt collectors are required to provide consumers notice of all of their rights, such as the right to cease communications, to stop receiving emails, texts, among other things, at what point does this cross into providing the consumer with legal advice? Where should we draw the line with that, with debt collectors' responsibility, where should we draw the line with what the debt collector's responsibility is or should be, versus the consumer's obligations related to the debts or determining their own rights? Debt collectors could face more lawsuits by not providing notice of enough rights to the consumer or providing incorrect information, etc. Margo or Rosanna, either one of you want to tackle that question?
Well, I think Mark should take that one.
I'm not quite sure. The question... it goes to the collector's concern that by providing a notice of rights, they might be providing legal advice?
I think essentially that's what the question is, yeah.
Well, The only notice of rights that are under discussion are notices of rights that are either required by state laws or would be required by the CFPB. Legal advice almost always, as far as I'm concerned, requires listening to the particular circumstances of the client and responding with not just what the law is, but how the law would apply to those circumstances. So articulating what the law is on a particular point never provides legal advice unless it's accompanied by how it would apply to the particular circumstances of the person in question. That's my answer to that.
It's a good answer. I don't really have anything to add except to say that I do know when it comes to, I think the hot spot for that is the 1099C dilemma. But your answer still stands. I mean, in terms of what really does constitute legal advice, but I think that's the problem. Two things. Calculating out of the expiration of the statute of limitations, interpreting whether the consumer has revived it by in words or actions or letters, and the 1099C issue, I think, is where debt collectors get very nervous about that. But be that as it may, that raises a good point.
I think another interesting area of discussion might surround the limited content message. And I'm curious to get Margo's thoughts, first of all, on this notion of a limited content message and whether there should be one or not, or should all communications be between a collector and an individual be subject to the FDCPA?
In my opinion, and the opinion of my colleagues and a lot of other people, there is no statutory authority for the Bureau to authorize a communication that is not covered under the rules for all communications. So this whole notion of a limited content message is nonsense, and we think illegal. Is that clear enough?
I think so.
It's funny.
Roseanne, would you care to weigh in on this, or we want to move on?
Well, can you hear me? I may have muted myself.
Yeah,
you
you're good.
The one comment I have, that whether or not it's legal or not legal, the one concern I have is, does it mean you can't leave a Zortman message? That might be rhetorical. You can't leave a Fody message? Because to me, whether or not it's legal or not that they've, or outside the scope of their authority to have come up with the idea, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, well, what kind of a message? You know, the debt collectors, what can we say to these people? And so they've come up with this very innocuous message. I know the industry groups would really prefer, if they could edit the message at all, it would be to simply state, this is not just a message, please call me back kind of a message, but this is a message regarding your ABC account, please call me back. Just as a creditor could leave such a message with the consumer. I know that they believe that would be more meaningful, but my personal wish is for the rule to make clear, let's say they make it a final rule, I don't know if it'll survive judicial scrutiny or not, but can you also use the Zortman message, which clearly, in my opinion, meets the requirements of the FDCPA.
So in my humble opinion, the whole limited content message may be such you may have gotten way more than what you wished for. So we read the limited content message rule to not just authorize the limited content message in the voicemail, which would be one thing, mm-hmm. but also to allow 7 calls a week to every non-consumer that the debt collector is trying to contact to find out where the consumer is for every account, which could be 49 calls a week if there's 7 medical debts involved, and The limited content message could even include calls to the consumer himself, where the consumer answers the phone hello and doesn't identify themselves, and the consumer then is provided with this message, and the consumer could then respond with some information that actually the consumer might not say if the consumer didn't know that the caller was a debt collector. Hmm. So the limited content message goes way beyond just authorizing the particular kind of voicemail that you were talking about. Also, the whole need for a voicemail, Roseanne and I have been talking about coming up with a FODI fix for almost 20 years, but the whole need for that is far less important now that everybody has their own cell phones. Almost, kids have their own cell phones. So, you know who you're calling, and you're not calling a general phone system. You're calling a specific person. Number one. Number two, you have these alternative methods of communicating with that person. So the need for the FODI fix that existed 15 years ago is not nearly as acute.
Oh. Well, that may be. Do you think consumer groups, though, agree or disagree that, all deception and trickery aside, if we have to even call, let's just put that conversation aside. I mean, if you owe the money, do consumer groups believe obstacles to communication are in any way, shape, or form okay?
No, and nor do we think, and we've never been advocating obstacles for communication. But I think where we're coming from is that quite often consumers who do owe the money can't pay. And the reason that they owe it and can't pay is because something terrible has happened to them. So calling them seven times a week and texting them and emailing them isn't going to enable them to pay. It's mm-hmm. just going to browbeat them into possibly paying something that they can't afford, where they need that money to pay the rent or for food or something else, just to make the call stop.
Yeah. Were you part of that conversation where there was actually an idea floated that let's give consumers some sort of a temporary safe harbor? Like if in fact you do not have a job and you're recuperating from a surgery, fill in the blank tragedy, that you could almost have a suspension period. Were you in that conversation earlier this year?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well, it was kind of the idea that maybe there needs to be a safe harbor for a hardship situation, but whether or not that does not seem to be on anyone's radar, so neither here nor there.
We had a question come in about the limited content message. Wouldn't the alternative to not leaving a limited content message be that the collectors will call more and not leave any message to the consumer?
Well, I guess, how would we know that? I mean, because they can't leave a message, so they'll just call. I suppose that's possible.
Well, they can call, so they can call even after leaving a message under this proposal. So they can call and leave seven messages for each account. So if they're collecting five debts, they can leave 35 messages in a week.
Mm-hmm. Or they could, one problem we're having with that, though, is how, from an industry standpoint, most debt collectors, once they really do, the majority of the debt collectors, once they actually have a consumer on the phone, would rather take a holistic approach. They're not going to say, okay, I'm going to call you back in 2 minutes, then we're going to talk about just such and such card. Then we're going to talk, I'll call you back, then we're going to call about your other credit card. I mean, they usually, once you're on the phone, want to speak about everything. So in practice, while I know it's technically possible, I don't even, and maybe some creditors don't want, it's possible that some creditors will say, I don't want you talking about my blah, blah, blah account with so-and-so's blah, blah, blah. You know, we don't want you mixing that. So that's a dicey one, but I think in practice, most debt collectors are going to try to have a holistic approach to the collection practice.
Well, that's good.
It doesn't take away. If you had 35 calls every day for 3 weeks, it's entirely possible the courts would say that is still deemed to be harassment under the statute.
No, there's a safe harbor under the proposed regs. So long as you're within the number, you can't have violated the harassment provision.
Oh, you can't at all? I guess a lot of the people are opining that this does not, it's a floor, not a ceiling. Maybe it's a ceiling, not a floor. But that while it is a safe harbor, it doesn't take away the ability to prove that it was done with the intent to harass or annoy. But that remains.
Well, I hope that's correct, but I just was working on that section, and I think we read it differently.
Okay.
Yeah, effective of complying with frequency limits. This is 14 B4.
Yep.
A debt collector who does not exceed the frequency limits in B2 of this section complies with B1, which is no harassment, the natural consequence of no conduct, the natural consequences to harass. And the statute, and does not, based on the frequency of the telephone calls, violate paragraph A of this section or section 1031 or 1036 of Dodd-Frank. So we read that as a safe harbor. So long as you don't exceed the number of calls, it doesn't matter what the natural consequence of that conduct was.
Well, I see that what you're pointing out, but they are saying that is not a it cannot limit or it doesn't nullify the statute. So maybe that's
well, it says that it does.
It says it
whether
does.
Or not it legally does is another question.
Right, right. Remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, we've just about reached the top of the hour. I've got a bunch of questions in the queue that I don't think we're going to have time to get to, unfortunately, and unless the questions that I come up with that we probably won't get to. But I did want to give Margo and Roseanne both the chance to summarize their thoughts or maybe talk about something that they didn't get a chance to talk to today because we just ran out of time before we wrap up for the audience. So since Roseanne went first the last time, Margo, we'll let you go first this time.
I would just thank you for the opportunity of soliciting our views on the rule, and hope that you help me advocate for a better and fairer rule for consumers, because even though it might inconvenience collectors overall, it will assist those collectors who want to abide by the law and the intent of the law.
Excellent. Thank you. Roseanne?
I would have to say that my biggest concern about the next phase of these proposed rules would be the fact that we've got them out there, they're considered proposed. Any material, substantive, dramatic deviation from the proposed rules could trigger some issues under the Administrative Procedures Act. I hope that I mentioned playing within the lanes. I hope the CFPB does not create huge departures from the proposed rules, or we may see even greater delays in what has what I consider to be, and I think most industry participants consider to be, a long overdue clarification of the FDCPA. Special thanks to Margo, though. I really, really, really do appreciate it, Margo, and so does Mike. It's very enlightening to listen to you. And
absolutely.
See you again soon.
Yes, thank you. And
well, before we, sorry, Margaret, go ahead.
I was just going to say to Roseanne to say hello to her son and her dog for me.
Same to you. We have a wedding on Saturday.
Oh, wow.
Well, excellent. Before I let everybody go, allow me to thank Roseanne and Margo for their insights and their time today. Special thanks should go to Roseanne for getting Margo to participate today. That was all her. I'm not taking any of the credit for that. She deserves all of it. So this webinar definitely would not have been possible without her and without Margo. So thank you very much for participating. I really appreciate it. I also want to thank Ontario Systems one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.ontariosystems.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated. I apologize if we didn't get to your questions. One final reminder to take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the best use to you. A recording of this event, for the people who asked, will be posted to accountsrecovery.net webinar recordings page later today. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Margo, Roseanne, one last time, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Excellent, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.